And we're back. Hello. This is Keep It, in case you thought it was, I don't know, Pod Save the World.
Because we're in their studio.
You know, we are. We are. We have a brand new studio. It is large. It is in charge.
This desk is so wide. I feel like you're going to throw to me for sports.
There's a big American flag behind us.
Right.
It's
unsettling.
I don't know.
Sinister.
I can only sort of see Lewis's face.
Right. She's on the other side of a mic, and we're sort of, it's like, I can only see her eyes, so it's like we're flirting.
The stage is so huge. It's like we're at the Roundabout Theater doing After Miss Julie. Anyway, as you can tell, Kara Brown is back.
Oh, hello.
From, I don't know.
Where were you? I was working.
Mm-hmm. Meghan Markle wasn't here either. I have questions. Why are you both gone?
We'll talk about that later.
Okay.
My dad listened to the podcast last week. He goes, so is Meghan coming? I was like, Dad, no. Stop. Don't believe Ira, Dad.
I fooled
your dad. Is Meghan coming?
Oh, I love your dad.
I know. He's a good guy.
Have him come on this show.
He will be statesmanlike, dry, and then leave early. Yes. Oh, he can?
Yeah.
He looks exactly like me. You'd be surprised.
Okay. Well. We're back. All three of us are here again. The news just keeps on rolling on. I mean, we got a lot of things to talk about this week. We're going to talk about Jameela Jamil and her detox tea crusade. We're going to talk about George H.W. Bush.
My girl.
R.I.P. Thanks for preempting Days of Our Lives this week. and we will also be talking about Priyanka Chopra and her royal wedding, apparently. We will be doing that with Franklin Leonard from The Blacklist. But before then, Ariana Grande dropped a video.
She did.
For Thank You Next. We love the song. Do we like the video?
I hated the video.
Really?
I think she's charming, but she would have been charming in like a send-up of American History X. I mean, just Mean Girls is so...
Curb stop those Nazis.
Mean Girls is so passe. It's passe to make fun of people who quote Mean Girls too much. I thought it was like beneath her. It's something, if Katy Perry did it, we'd drag her for it, I thought.
Well, Katy Perry wouldn't have had a bop like Thank You Next.
There's
which
that.
Would have also been... I mean, I didn't think it was like groundbreaking, but I thought it was... But it wasn't just Mean Girls, right? It was 13 Going on 30. It was Bring It On. The Bring It On scene was pretty great.
I think if it were only Bring It On, it would have been awesome.
And I liked the Legally Blonde stuff too. I thought the Legally Blonde stuff was super cute.
I liked how she was reading books on like...
Immigration law, yeah.
a little subtweet.
I mean, the thing is... There's only so much, there's only so much artistry you're going to get from her. She's like a pop star. And to me, this was like as sort of edgy as she's going to get. And I was like, I'll take it because the song is a bop.
It felt like her Hotline Bling, you know, how like Drake with his videos really knows how to capitalize on meme culture and social media reaction. And this video was literally designed, you know, to be memed.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So. And it already has been.
Yeah.
Did you see that someone memed her getting out of the Porsche, like the Legally Blonde scene.
With Wu Child the Ghetto.
Yeah, Wu Child the Ghetto.
Yes. That was beautiful.
By the way, Troye Sivan's acting in the video. He is kind of an actor sometimes, right? Man, the Lance Bass jumped out. Where was the charisma in that performance? I'm a little upset with Troye Sivan right now.
Wait, in the video?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. The Lance Bass jumped out.
Yeah.
I thought Lance was great and on the line.
Okay, well, moving right along.
He's better than Joey.
Did he have brown hair in that movie and on the line? There was something like weird that he did to...
Well, he was still straight then.
Yes.
Do you know what Joey Fatone does now?
A construction company?
That's incorrect. Okay. He is the announcer for the Steve Harvey Family Feud.
Oh.
Okay.
If you need any more game show tea, I'm here.
Okay. Well, that's a path.
It's a check.
It is a check. We love a check here at Keep It. Speaking of checks, though... I didn't even want to bring this up, but there was an awful review of this video on the website brought to you by Grindr,
which is my primary news source.
Of course. And I don't know. It's this author. accused the video of being transphobic, racist, said that she was in blackface.
What?
Said that Ariana was in blackface.
When?
And I don't know. This was also a trans white woman who wrote this. And I'm like, okay, girl. Like, maybe I saw the point with, it was sort of doofy for that dancer to be in the wig mm-hmm. the entire time. I didn't know what was going on with that. But maybe race, stay in your lane. And it just reminded me of, like, what we're going to talk about later with Jamila. This need to always have some sort of, like, hot take, and one, you know, spurred by people whose, you know, only introduction to critical theory is a Twitter thread,
right,
is really sort of the problem.
And just looking for something to react to. Because of that course. Video was designed to be innocuous and fun and popular. It was not designed to cause waves. It was designed to be incredibly popular, which it is. And so looking for some sort of more insidious thing in a piece of content that was not trying to do a lot is also bizarre.
Also, in that piece, the author interprets the Bring It On section as some sort of deeply offensive moment, but it doesn't understand that it's a reference to Bring It On.
Has she seen the movie?
Yeah.
No, clearly. Because at one point she writes the Toros are wearing, like, red, white, and blue when they're wearing red, white, and black.
Black, yeah.
And then she refers to the Clovers' outfits as a Pan-African green and gold.
Oh, no.
The piece was...
do you write about this video? You haven't even seen the movie.
Anyways, it turned into a real mess. And I'm sorry we don't have more time to talk about it. But Into removed her name from the article because allegedly she was getting death threats.
VHS copies of Bring It On thrown through her window.
Yes. And then there was also revelations that maybe she had sexually assaulted some people.
Whatever.
Can we add more wrinkles to this somehow? Thanks.
Yeah. I was just like, where was the editor? They added an editor's note and someone hilariously responded, so there was an editor. Do better, people.
Just at least watch the thing that you're writing about.
Yeah. When we're back, we're going to talk about some other hot takes. I hope you have some on detox teas. So Jamila Jamil of The Good Place, we all know her as Tahani on The Good Place. She has been on quite the Twitter and media stir over the past few weeks. She's been dragging celebs for endorsing those detox teas, you know, those flat tummy teas, yeah. that everyone from, like, Demi Lovato to Iggy to Kim to Cardi B have been promoting for years. She also now wants a ban on airbrushing in celebrity photos, saying that it should be illegal. All right, Shakira. She also told The Cut that her vow is to never stop coming for people, men and women, who perpetuate this gross culture of forcing women to remain small and doll-like in order to be accepted by society.
She, to me, has a little bit of the Azealia Banks syndrome, where she may not be wrong, but goddamn would she shut up.
Yeah.
Like, she isn't fully wrong, but you're like, God, you're annoying. I don't even care. Like, she almost makes me want to buy a flat tummy tea.
Right.
Just to be like, shut up. Shut up.
And I'm loving it.
Yeah.
Also, there's something about, like, the targets she picks seem very easy to me. I don't know, like, I don't need someone to really yell at Kim Kardashian anymore. I'm not saying I'm, like, a super fan or whatever, but it's just, oh, you don't say, she's part of the problem. It's 2009, I figured it out.
Yeah.
We've already got theater actors yelling at her and her husband for being on their phones during Cher the Musical on Broadway. We don't need Jamila being like, hey, did you know Kim Kardashian is problematic?
Right.
Right.
And of the list of things that are harmful to women that should be illegal, airbrushing is the one that you go for. Airbrushing, that should be illegal. It should be outlawed. And the other...
Sis, I like to look good.
Right,
okay?
That's the other thing, which
I love an airbrush.
It's a little... And, like, I know that she's talked about, like, she struggled with an eating disorder and, like, you know, everyone has their own issues in history. But it's a little irritating when
I can't shop at H&M or Zara.
It's a little irritating, right, when a very thin, conventionally a gorgeous woman is out here like nobody could airbrush. And she posts a picture of herself without airbrushing and she looks fucking incredible. And it's like, no, if that's what people are competing with, then yes, please cover up the bags under my eyes.
It's almost like she's become Tahani.
Yes.
Or maybe she already was Tahani. Because yes, that is literally a scene from a comedy where you're like, women, we don't need makeup to look beautiful. And then she walks out and she's glowing anyway.
Exactly. It's the Alicia Keys, like, you're spending thousands and thousands of dollars on skincare. You're already Alicia Keys. You're already beautiful. You not wearing makeup isn't doing a lot for me personally.
Also, it just, in a way, shames people who like using Photoshop. I don't know. It's just, if she had just said, obviously there are dangers to, like, you know, images in the media that are manipulated in ways that, like, the people putting those images out aren't saying. But to say make it illegal strikes me as, I don't know, immature. I don't know.
Well, it's also because she seems to have predicated her career at this point on constantly critiquing her peers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of, it would be different if she, like other celebrities, had been, oh my God, I was just on this magazine cover and I was Photoshopped.
Right.
I would prefer that my fans and people see what I really look like. It didn't seem like the Photoshopping happened to her.
Right.
She's just mad at other people for doing it. And maybe some of those celebrities asked for it.
I also find the frequency with which she specifically goes after women to be a little odd, which is not to say that women cannot uphold the patriarchy and are not also part of the problem. But she seems, to me at least, from what I've seen, she's mostly criticizing women.
Yeah.
Which is
critique the men
is
at
a
the
weird
top
way.
Of
yeah.
the company. Like, did she have anything to say about Victoria's Secret and that whole drama? Why are you attacking Cardi B?
Did she have anything to say
about trying to get a check?
Yeah, like about issues that are like, go to Planned Parenthood, girl. Like, that's what we need from you. Go raise some money for some shit that's actually, which is not to say that these are not things that should be discussed and all of that. But I find her, the sort of crusade like nature of it, to as opposed to sort of mentioning it in an interview here and there and like drawing attention to things when it's necessary, to make this your fight of all of the issues women are facing is just, it's just not interesting to me.
I think the phrase double agent for the patriarchy is just way more insulting than it needs to be. It's just, again, it's like, if the patriarchy is the problem, talk about that. Specifically calling somebody out and saying they're a double agent for the patriarchy is like, well, you're as bad as a horrible man. And it's like, that's not the truth.
It's like they're Irina Derevko.
Yeah.
what's weird is she also had this moment where she attacked Cardi. When she talked about Cardi and the detox tea, she wrote, they got Cardi B on the laxative nonsense detox tea. God, I hope all these celebrities all shit their pants in public the way the poor women who buy this nonsense upon their recommendations do. Not that they actually take this shit. They just flog it because they need more money. And what's funny about it is Cardi responded and said, I will never shit my pants because there's public bathrooms everywhere. Ooh, and bushes.
That's super wild. Very wild.
But what I found funniest about it was that Jamila, like, gleefully shared the article where she said, I hope that they shit their pants in public, and was like, LOL at BuzzFeed or whatever outlet asking Cardi for a response quote. It's like, isn't that what you wanted?
Right.
Like, why would you go after one of the most famous people in the game right now unless you were expecting them to respond to you? This sort of whole, I'm just trying to do the right thing and like, oh, people are just like trying to create drama out of it is funny and comical when you are constantly creating drama.
It's, you know, people can't necessarily help how they are. And it's, I just find with her, I just don't want to listen to her talk about this. I find it a little grating. And she doesn't, to me, seem like she really knows what she's talking about. She's never, again, has she read a book? She's not linking to, like, articles written by serious people breaking down these issues in a smart way. Like, it just seems very surface level.
She had a kerfuffle when she was talking about the body positivity movement and how that had sort of been co-opted by skinny white women. And then, you know, some black women on Twitter were sort of like, I mean, we're talking about body positivity over here just because
you don't know about
happening. Yeah, just because you don't know about it doesn't mean it's not happening. And she apologized for that. But it's like, yeah, if this is going to be your crusade, I don't know.
Read a book. She just doesn't really seem, she doesn't feel to me like she really knows what she's talking about, which is the fundamental issue always, right? Like, it's not about her being famous.
I mean, if it were the 90s, Oprah would give you a talk show because of that, right? But that's not happening anymore.
And it's not about her being famous and beautiful and all of that. It's like, she doesn't seem super well-informed, and that's a problem.
The big think piece she wrote about it somewhat recently, it just felt like it was operating from a place, it reminded me of a high school newspaper, of operating from a hunch and a feeling, and then assuming, because you believe strongly in it, that that's enough support for it.
Well,
not that there
Spotlight
wasn't truth
happened.
In it. That's exactly right. Yes. It was basic journalism.
Anyway.
I will say, though, the sketch she did about, like, whatever, like the farting because of the Tommy T thing, in a way, I do think that is the kind of obnoxiousness that does draw the right attention to the issue. Like, look how absurd it is that we're, like, feeding this to, like, people en masse or whatever.
I prefer the video to
that's what I mean. Yeah.
The constant tweets. I'm like, if you want to, you're on a comedy show, so how about you be funny when attacking this instead of just being so annoyingly didactic?
And it gives it the sort of seriousness that the issue deserves, which is, yes, the flat tummy tea is part of a larger issue, but it's not a pressing issue for people.
The issue,
yeah. And so, like, this sort of dumb video treats it with the seriousness with which the entire issue deserves.
No. Anyway.
She really is Tahani, though.
She is Tahani.
It's kind of, I mean, that photo of this isn't Photoshopped and she looks resplendent. She looks incredible. I'm like, girl, she really thought she made a point. She really thought, like, yes, I'm showing them I'm a normal and there's not a pore in sight. I'm like, get out of here.
It's like when other really hot people tell you, like, you just need to, like, exercise, go to the gym.
Or, like, I used to be ugly. Well, you're not now, so who cares?
Drink more water. No, it reminds me of, like, I felt like that was a very late 2000s thing of supermodels in magazines, like, not wearing makeup. And it's like, oh, you don't say, Cindy Crawford, you look fantastic. What? Question mark.
You're the only person who can drink Coke.
Right.
And not break out.
Right.
Anyway, I think we've had enough of that.
Yeah.
When we're back, I'm going to talk about Jeb's daddy. Friday, George H.W. Bush passed away in his home in Texas with his children at his side. The 94-year-old former president received sweeping praise from those on both sides of the aisle, while both the Obamas and Clintons nostalgically remembered their interactions and stories of the former president. And, you know, I know every once in a while y'all might like for us to do something nice and easy. It's just one thing. We don't ever do nothing nice and easy. Do it nice and rough. So we're not going to be doing that sweeping praise. We're going to have a real talk about George H.W. Bush.
You know what? When he died, I was reading, you know, stuff about him, and there's this really interesting thing, which is he's so boring. He was a boring, bad president. He wasn't even that good at ignoring AIDS. Reagan was way better at it. He's the Mac Daddy of ignoring AIDS. Nancy Reagan, she's like, I can't talk about AIDS. It doesn't match the China.
Let's, like, literally just jump right into that. Bush was a president notorious for ignoring the AIDS crisis. Literally every AIDS activist group during the time was pissed off at him, had ads like from ACT UP that called him a serial killer for ignoring how many men and women were dying of this disease. And on the heels of the crisis in the 80s, he inherited Reagan's sort of penchant for ignoring everything that happened. And later, he eventually did sort of sign the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Ryan White Care Act, which protected people with HIV from discrimination and funded treatment for people with AIDS. But by that point, it was 10 years into the epidemic. 150,000 cases of people with HIV had been reported in the U.S., and 100,000 people had died. So
thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Buddy. Yeah.
Good try.
And there's been sort of this thing that happened with Reagan, that happened with McCain, which we talked about on this show, of people sort of mad at you for bringing up any of this at all.
And just all people are doing, I will say, is stating what he did. They're just saying these are the things that happened while this person was president. If they sound bad, that is not the fault of the facts. That is the fault of the person who did them. And the notion that simply saying he ignored the AIDS crisis and hundreds of thousands of people died, it just saying that he ramped up this fucking bullshit war on drugs and thousands of people ended up in prison for no reason because of him, that's just saying shit that he did. If it's bad, it's his fault. It's not my fault. It's not anyone's fault that he did bad things.
Also, the reason why we have problems like Trump, you know, the real reason, not, you know, because of the working class and the forgotten man, it is because America has this sort of penchant for ignoring history. And I think that is what so much of our art that is about the AIDS epidemic is about. You know, it's about people being reminded of the fact that this even happened. When I was in London, I saw this new play, The Inheritance, which is about the AIDS crisis and about how people in Manhattan, gays in this age, are learning about it. And just sort of how if you forget that history, it's going to be gone forever. And so when you have people saying, don't bring this up, it just adds to the fact that we're going to be forgetting about it if we don't bring it up.
And by the way, we are the ones who have to keep passing it on to each other. It doesn't feel like it's like formally embedded in like, you know,
it's
academic
not in history books.
You know what I'm saying?
They only talk about this shit on the news when someone who ignored it died.
Right.
So what else can we talk about?
It's also this weird notion that the people that, and it's frankly usually white people, who were like, you know, he's dead now, we can admit that he did some bad things, but he also did some good things. No, because I don't know, man. You said like you're out here saying we need more prisons. We don't need more prisons. We've never needed more prisons. And so people that were negatively affected by that, the notion that they should just be like, well, you know, he had some good moments. Like, it's just to me, it's the privilege of being able to look at a situation that way and see both sides because the other side of it is not actively harming.
It's because you were not caring for gay men
your
who
friends
died.
Were dying of AIDS your
you
relatives weren't getting locked up for
incarcerated.
Tiny being incarcerated for tiny amounts of crack or whatever bullshit, like, you were not affected by this. So yes, I understand how you could look back at this person and be like, well, he wasn't all bad, but like, you're if all your friends are dead, then you don't have the luxury of being able to look at a situation
you
like
also
that.
Have the fact that he kicked off his presidential campaign in 1988 with that infamous Willie Horton
right.
ad because he was going against Michael Dukakis, and basically the ad was talking about Horton, who had been in prison serving a life sentence for murder, and on a weekend furlough program he murdered a man and raped a woman, and the ad was very clear with a mugshot letting you know that Horton was black and his victims were white. And it was just sort of like, this is Dukakis's fault, ignoring the fact that the weekend furlough program was created by a Republican. It was also popular in California under Reagan. This was really just an ad to get white people whipped up about black criminals coming to rape and murder them. And he went from that to starting his racist war on drugs, where, you know, there was that time where he was in the Oval Office and he held up a crack cocaine bag and was like, they're even selling crack outside the White House. And then it was found out that he scammed that entire thing and they lured a drug dealer to outside the White House so that they could perpetuate that scam on TV.
If you can read that Washington Post story, you absolutely should. It was a story in the Washington Post that breaks down the scam exactly of how they lured a drug dealer basically to the White House and to sort of do this whole facade that they're selling crack right outside the White House.
Washington Post, speaking of spotlight. No, wait, that was the Boston Globe.
No, that was, Spotlight.
Washington
that's
Post
the
was
Post.
The
yes.
Post. Yes. Meryl Streep caftan.
Yes.
Yes, that's a 1989 article by Michael Isikoff. We'll provide it in the episode link for people to be able to read it. But he was a scammer and he was a racist scammer, too. And the only difference is it was, you know, elegant dynasty scamming instead of Trump's Roseanne trailer park scam.
Right. There was a time when you could be a bad president in a cute, folksy way, which was reassuring to people at the time.
I think the other thing that really bothers me is this idea of, right, like, you can't speak ill of the dead, which clearly didn't apply to Michael Brown, didn't apply to Trayvon Martin, certainly doesn't apply all the time. Anytime, you know, a black person is murdered by the cops and they're like, oh, but he smoked weed once. So this bullshit that we can't speak ill of the dead, go fuck yourself, because you speak ill of people all of the time when they're gone. And the notion that someone who was actually harming people, who was actually making people's lives worse, now that they're gone, people can't, like, say what they think of them is ridiculous.
And also, I think in addition to that, there's a general discomfort with just saying about white authority figures, this person mostly fucking sucked, and not paying them respect. Like, if we don't pay them respect, we are, I don't know, like, it's not civil
or
enough.
Or you're not respecting the institution.
Yeah,
I think that's
right.
What they think they're doing is like, well, you know, he was a president and I respect the institution of the presidency. And so I have to give him respect. And it's like, no, you don't. Absolutely not. You have someone in power right now who clearly proves that you don't have to do that.
And see, there's also a direct line from Bush ignoring the AIDS epidemic and also his racist war on drugs, because now you look in the future, that intersection of him attacking gay people and him attacking black people is like, you look at HIV right now and it is still a serious problem. You know, it's like there's a lifetime risk of 1 in 99 Americans getting it and 1 in 11 white, gay and bisexual men. But it's like 1 in 2 African-American gay and bisexual men will get that in their lifetime. And we don't talk about HIV and AIDS in this country the way that we should, and we don't have the progress that we should, because we spent 10 years not doing anything about it while people were dying. And, you know, it's this problem of whitewashing history, and it ends up whitewashing AIDS in general, because, you know, you end up thinking, oh, this is only a disease that affected white gay men. Mm-hmm. You know, like when that first CDC report came out in the 80s, it included 5 cases of white gay men who got it, and it excluded the 2 black gay men who'd got it. And there was even a report earlier this year, I think, and like, HIV Plus magazine, about how, like, in 1969, the first victim of HIV was actually like a 15-year-old black teenager. So it's like, when we don't discuss these things, when we decide that we need to be nice and that we need to, you know, just like keep the peace, that is how people end up dying.
And by the way, someone like him, like the kinder, gentler republicanism, these people specifically found space and created space for, like, horrible, insane ideologues. And that's who's our president now.
Also, you know, his last tweet was to what's her name? Susan Collins. Was that the one? Like, congratulating her on her vote for Kavanaugh. Like, fuck you. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Fuck you.
I was about to be like,
congratulating her on confirming a probable rapist to the Supreme Court. That's your last tweet. That is the last thing that you or whoever operates your Twitter feed chose to put up there. Like, give me a break.
Yeah.
Give me Jeb. A break. Yeah, Jeb.
That's the only thing he lets Jeb do. He sends out the official tweets. Jeb's going to fuck up next week and send out a tweet, and they're going to be like, wait a second, isn't he dead?
Right.
Jeb is going to just unleash his real feelings about the love he never got.
By the way, you know what I thought was also telling is the minute he died, how quickly Dana Carvey trended, because truly the most culturally relevant thing about him was just that impression of him. You know what
right.
I mean?
And, well, that also goes to the creed is that, like, so many people who I know were trying to hop on social media and be like, let's not speak ill of the dead, let's not do this and that. I'm like, bitch, you don't even remember George H.W. Bush being president.
Yeah, no, please.
I don't.
No, he raised more of a stink about broccoli than AIDS. That's all I remember.
Also, he doesn't know. He doesn't know what we're talking about.
He doesn't.
Right.
The only good thing he did was when he was petty and skipped Trump's inauguration.
That was good.
Pretending he was too sick to travel. And then didn't he go to the Super Bowl?
Yeah, like...
Three Doors Down made it.
I can't believe they're letting him go.
Trump to the funeral.
Letting Trump go to the funeral. I loved. I saw a headline that was like, Trump will attend the funeral, but he won't give a eulogy. Which, no shit. Like, did anyone actually think he was gonna
write a poem? Yeah.
Right.
He can barely speak coherently when he asks for his McDonald's order in the morning. You think he's gonna sit up there and give a eulogy? I guess basically it's like, don't forget the AIDS crisis. Don't forget the racist war on drugs. And we should be talking about these things more than, just when these people die.
Yeah. And also, you can use the opportunity of, like, this person is gone and these are now the things we're talking about. That's how the news works. Like, yeah. I don't know why everyone is surprised every time this happens. Like, why are we talking about these things? Because he's dead and now we're talking about what he did. This is what happens literally every single time.
Yeah. And speaking as a gay black man, if I can have a Kara moment, I know that we always talk about The Normal Heart. We always talk about Angels in America, The Baltimore Waltz by Paula Vogel, which I love. But, you know, we should do more to read about the AIDS crisis from the people actually majority afflicted by it, which were black people. I think that people should read Not Straight, Not White, Black Gay Men, From the March on Washington to the AIDS Crisis by Kevin Mumford. And a friend of mine online, Donna Smith, is an HIV positive poet who has a lot of poetry that I think people should read.
And people around the globe.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not just... This fucked up a lot of things for a lot of people, guys.
Yeah. AIDS and HIV is still a very serious issue in the world. And there are more cases every year. And if you're a person who needs health insurance, if you're a person who needs that, that you can get on PrEP or any sort of medication where you can get your HIV under control, because we're able to do that now. Unfortunately, a lot of people in our country don't have access to affordable health care and don't have access to, you know, the means to visit a doctor all of the time, the way that we may think it's just so commonplace to do in LA or New York or something. Until December 15th, you can sign up for health care. Trump ain't telling people about it, but Obamacare, you can sign up for it before the deadline, which is Saturday, December 15th. You can find an affordable plan at healthcare.gov. The website works. Go there. Get yourself a fucking healthcare plan. When we're back, we're going to attempt to recap 15 seasons of Quantico.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Quick question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.
Over the weekend, Priyanka Chopra, actress and singer of number one Indian iTunes hit Exotic featuring Pitbull, got married to former Disney star Nick Jonas in a Hindu ceremony at the Umaid Bawan Palace in India. Shortly after, they had another wedding, a Christian ceremony presided over by Jonas's pastor dad. They had a lot of weddings.
They had a lot of weddings.
They had a lot of weddings. To talk about these weddings, we are joined by creator of The Blacklist, Franklin Leonard.
And expert in weddings, Nick Jonas and Priyanka Chopra.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I'm none of those. I am the Blacklist guy, but the rest of the stuff, I'm not an expert.
Ira, the fact that you called Nick Jonas former Disney star is real rude.
I am the only one on this panel who has owned every Jonas Brother
you
album.
You sure are.
Who has owned every Nick Jonas
sure
album.
Sure you are, yep.
This is a source of credibility.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, I'm happy for you.
Okay, they were pushing me away.
Okay. I get it.
The year 3000?
Can I say something about this couple? I think they are the most famous, both of them, as famous as you can be while still being a boring couple. I mean, God, if you thought Joshua Jackson and Diane Kruger were too exciting, I've got a couple for you.
They are so famous. Like, yeah. They're both huge stars, and they got married, and it just feels like everyone is confused. Like, no one I saw was, like, mad or anything. Everyone was just like, oh, they really did that. Those two. They really
It's like Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively. Like, oh, sure.
It's like, when I remember that I'm gay, when I'm like, uh-huh. I don't really care about Priyanka Chopra. I mean, like, I'm not a woman, so I'm not like, oh my God, like, here's Priyanka. And I'm not like a straight man who's like, oh my God, Priyanka. You know, I don't think she's really crossed over into like gays adoring her. Like, we weren't watching Quantico. Yeah.
Well, but she just has the entire nation of India that adores
yeah.
her, though.
Yeah, so just I think bit, and the diaspora on top of
yeah,
it. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, she has that, but...
Not Iris Phantom.
Okay, but here's the thing. She got married to Nick Jonas, and she is now going to be on the cover of Vogue. So she is being positioned, I feel like, very thirstily to make her famous in the U.S. And I don't care.
No, it's like
she has India, but India doesn't seem to be enough for her.
I'm supportive That's of true. This, but like for instance, I still don't really know what Quantico was. That feels like a show to me that when it started out was like, we're gonna get all this correct information right about like whatever the FBI, CIA.
No, let me tell you about
it. And then it turns into like a witch turned over. Quantico.
The first season of Quantico was actually. The first half of the first season was quite strong. The problem was the premise of the show became moot at the beginning of the second half of the first season, and then the show didn't make sense anymore. I once heard someone describe it as a Shonda Rhimes show that they did not want to pay Shonda Rhimes for, which kind of made a lot of because it was like yep. hot people.
It's true.
You know,
a lot of sort of emotional drama set against a backdrop of like professional capability.
But it didn't make enough sense.
Well, because it was these sexy people trying to stop a terrorist. And it was
no, it had too, already happened. Yeah, well, the terrorists had already happened.
It was two timelines.
It was like the terrorist attack had happened on New York and Priyanka was accused of it. And there was also the timeline where they all joined Quantico and were becoming FBI agents.
Yeah.
And then I knew they fucked up with part two of season one because they didn't catch the terrorist. And like apparently there was a bigger terrorist that they had to find. But then the flashbacks were like their second semester. And they added a bunch of people to the cast who were somehow supposed to have been there in the first half
they
of
just
season
folded
one.
Them in. Yeah.
We just never met them.
Oh, like Fantasy Island or like Gilligan's Island.
You know,
they just show up.
I actually got into kind of a Twitter fight with I think the creator, the showrunner of Quantico, because I was watching the show because
Josh Safran.
Yeah, I think so. Because I think she's stunning, and I was like, this is the first time I think an Indian woman starred in a primetime
right.
show.
Yeah.
So I was like, cool, I'm going to support this. However, I'm watching the show, and at one point, they introduce her mother, who's an Indian woman, and then they introduce her father, who was white. And I was like, wait a minute, because in real life, she's not mixed. And so I had tweeted about it, and the creator, whoever, like tweeted back at me, and he got kind of persnickety about it. I'm like, that was such an unnecessary attempt to like whitewash her and the show. It had nothing to do with the plot. Her whole thing was that her dad was also an FBI agent. Couldn't he have? I assume we've had Indian FBI agents. It didn't make any sense, and that's my Quantico memory.
Well, this is what happens when you don't pay for Shonda Rhimes.
Right, exactly.
I think
right.
this, let this be a lesson to us all.
Exactly.
Shondico.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of my whole thing with Priyanka, right? Like, she's hugely famous in India. And so over here, since Quantico, it feels like we've had this attempt to make Priyanka sort of happen here, but I don't know if it's working. I mean, she did Baywatch, and she
really?
Was the villain. She
was that this year?
She was villain in Baywatch like
year.
A year ago.
Yeah, it was last year.
It was last year. She was the villain in Baywatch, and now this year, like, she's finally on the cover of Vogue, but I'm disappointed that it's not on her own just sort of like merits of she should have been on Vogue before because she's a hugely popular star. And she's very beautiful and she looks great in dresses and couture, you know, and it's like she's on Vogue and it really seems like Anna Wintour is playing to the tabloid audience that wants the details of Priyanka and Nick's wedding.
I think it's a little bit too of when Hollywood decides that they want a person to be a thing. And I think they do it a lot more with people of color where they're like, great, now we have our beautiful Indian woman. And they picked one, as opposed to I'm sure there are countless actresses who maybe would be better in certain projects or whatever it is. But they've decided they've picked the one and are really putting everything behind it. And I have no ill will towards Priyanka Chopra, but you do sort of wonder who we aren't getting to meet because everyone has decided that this is the one sort of person that we're throwing everything behind.
Also, I find it just wild that she's with Nick Jonas.
I know.
Relationship still seems weird to me.
In what way? I'm curious.
A person who grew up like sort of big a fan of Nick Jonas and the Jonas Brothers, it's just now weird to see
him. You're saying you would not have pegged him with an Indian superstar 10 years old or 10 years his senior?
No. And
he dated Kate Hudson, right?
Yeah.
So anyway,
what?
But he loves older women. Yeah, he dated Kate Hudson.
They just don't really. You know what? I was just like, I don't know what's happening. I was just like confused. It feels like a simulation.
Not that Joe Jonas and Sophie Turner seems to make
that
much more sense.
Who's that?
Sansa.
Yeah, Sansa
from Game of Thrones.
Oh, guys, I don't watch Game of Thrones. Me neither, please. All the women have prom hair.
Anyway, Franklin, let's talk about Circe. Yeah, talk about the gate.
I'm excited for the return. I'm not going to lie.
Is it coming back soon?
It is coming back. Yeah. HBO did that thing where the final season of the show airs like two, three years after the last season, which they started with The Sopranos just because they can.
They can. And I'll be there. I've been waiting for 2 years. So.
I think they're doing that with Silicon Valley, too. Like, Silicon Valley's coming back. Like, they don't.
Is that true?
I don't think they've even started.
That feels like a slightly different dynamic.
No, but they haven't even. I love Silicon Valley, but they haven't started. I don't think they've started The Room because they're doing Barry instead. It was like the showrunner is doing Barry also, so they're like.
Well, you know, Game of Thrones is like Silicon Valley with dragons.
Your elevator
pitch?
They're
all, at the end of the day,
Kumal's in Game of Thrones, too.
If I sit down and watch this.
The theme is all lust for power in both, really.
If I sit down and watch this and there's not a nerd freaking out within the first 5 minutes on a dragon, I'm going to be very irritated.
Well, you can just go to Twitter afterwards and trust me, there'll be some nerds freaking out.
Well, so on this Priyanka tip.
Yes.
Franklin, you are the creator of The Blacklist.
I am indeed.
Which... tell us about The Blacklist, what it does, you know, because you talk a lot about diversity in Hollywood.
I do.
And this is exactly connected with Priyanka and how she's sort of like the only one now.
So The Blacklist started almost 15 years ago. It was just an informal survey of Hollywood's most liked unproduced screenplays. I was trying to find good scripts to read and good writers to work with. And so I surveyed all of my peers and said, send me a list of your 10 favorite scripts that haven't been made yet. And I'll share the entire list. And then very quickly, it became this sort of prognosticator with some success about future success. So the first list, the two of the top three scripts were Lars and the Real Girl and Juno, which went on to be nominated for Best Original Screenplay. Obviously, Juno won. And since then, you know, in the 14 years since, we've sort of served early notice about future Best Picture winners, Best Screenplay winners. And then since then, we've become a business that you can submit your screenplay to our website and have it evaluated. And if it's good, we tell all of Hollywood, like, hey, you should probably do something with this.
And the website, then, do you find that there's more diversity in sort of The Blacklist and the scripts that you get submitted than what's being represented in Hollywood?
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's still not, what we're being submitted is still not, I think, representative of the country or the world as a whole. Like, it's just one example. You know, it is still roughly 65-35 in terms of men versus women submitting to the website, which I don't think reflects who's writing screenplays. I think it reflects who has sort of been culturally sort of trained to say, you know, type the end and then be like, where's my $1 million? And that's men. Whereas, you know, women will write an excellent screenplay and then be like, you know, I want to work on the second act just a little bit to get it perfect before I share it with anybody. And we even see that reflected in the sort of performance of the scripts on the site. Men have a pretty perfect bell curve in terms of the scores that they get. And women, the very bottom of that bell curve disappears. Like, they're not submitting garbage. Whereas men will submit garbage and expect that it's going to be their $3 million payday.
Yes, they will.
You basically touched on this, but it is astonishing how many of these scripts just go on to like win the Oscar.
Yeah,
I mean, like,
weird.
Manchester by the Sea is on this list. Like,
yeah.
when you see a script like that, are you immediately like when you read scripts, can you pick which one's going to go all the way?
I've been doing this for 15 years, and so I like to think that I have the ability to do that. And there are times when I read something, I'm like, this is genius, and if it can just get made, it'll go all the way. I mean, The King's Speech is actually a really good example of that. I had a stutter when I was a kid, so it, like, touched me. And I remember thinking, like, if they can just make this movie, it has real potential. And then there are other times I read things that I love that can't even get made for whatever reason, and who knows if they will ever get made and go the distance. But no, I mean, the track record is ridiculous. Like, there have been, like, 1,200 scripts on the list, 400 have gotten produced, they've been nominated for something like 275 Oscars, 50 wins, 4 of the last 10 Best Pictures, and 10 of the last 22 screenwriting Oscars.
Well, with a success rate like that, yeah. do you feel like you've seen sort of the Hollywood traditional kind of setup respond to the work that you're doing? Because you would think they would say, oh, wow, look at all, maybe we should look in places we haven't been looking before because it's very successful.
Yeah, I think that is happening. I think that there, you know, the Blacklist comes out in mid-December every year. I think that, you know, producers, directors, studio executives, actors sort of seek these scripts out and read them. So I don't know if the Blacklist itself is getting movies made, and I don't think I'd ever go so far as to say that, but I think it catalyzes a lot of attention around material that is really emotionally ambitious, and then people get involved who can then get movies made on the strength of their own name, on the strength of their own work, and then they go on to get produced. So I never want to overstate and be like, look, the Blacklist did all this shit. But at the same time, I think that we catalyze some reactions that help these things get made. I mean, like, Chris Terrio has said that Ben Affleck found out about Argo because of the Blacklist. You know, Benedict Cumberbatch said he read the Imitation Game script because it was the number one script on the Blacklist. Did we get it made? No, but we got them to read it.
Right.
And they got it made. So.
Well, so here's my question. What is the sort of percentage of people who end up on the Blacklist who are sort of, you know, maybe a fresh voice to Hollywood versus if Diablo Cody's next script were to end up on the Blacklist again? It's like, well, someone's going to make that, so.
Right. Well, hopefully. I mean, I think the reality is that you never quite know, and depending on what Diablo decides to write next, there may be impediments because of conventional wisdom about what works and what doesn't that prevent it from getting made. I think that, you know, look, every year the list has people that we know, just those of us who follow movies will know already, and then it has a ton of new names. I think the number one script almost every year is someone that I had never heard of before the list came out, which is really exciting. But, you know, the first list, I think Aaron Sorkin was in the top five. You know, he didn't.
Aaron Sorkin submitted to the Blacklist?
No, not to the website. It was part of the annual survey. But you know, was his movie going to get made regardless? Probably.
Yeah.
But I think that by being on the same list as Aaron Sorkin, if you're a newbie and someone says, "Look, I love this Aaron Sorkin script, but I love this thing from a nobody more," it validates that nobody in a way that being on a list of all nobodies never could.
Well, so then the list at the end of the year is people who submit to the website, but also
let me make that distinction. So the end of the year list is just an informal survey of all the executives who work as, you might call them, gatekeepers in Hollywood. They're executives at major film financiers and producers. The website functions as a totally separate entity, though there are writers who have uploaded their script to the site, gotten agents, had their movie produced, and then end up on the annual list because people have read it either through the site or elsewhere, and then they're like, this is one of the best scripts I read this year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a funnel to, at the end of the day, just trying to identify great talent wherever it lies and then helping those people get their work made and have sustainable careers.
Some of these racial breakdowns do you find? Are they different than what we're seeing in what's produced in Hollywood?
Yeah, I think that the submission rate to the website is roughly representative of the U.S. population as a whole. And I think we all know that in Hollywood, it's not representative of the United States as a whole.
But that's not proven.
No, yeah, exactly. There's no numbers behind that. But no, I think what we are seeing is more representative voices on that annual survey, which is really exciting. Like, I know this year's annual list, we are seeing a ton more representation of people of color. Last year was, by a significant margin, the most women we'd ever had on the list. And that number is sustained this year. We've sort of done the voting and done the counting, but the list hasn't come out yet. But we're seeing more movies about women and more movies written by women and more movies written by people of color and about people of color. So that's really exciting.
Can you pick just a single script that was the most exciting for you ever to read in the Blacklist history?
The King's Speech was always going to be one for me that, I mean, again, I had a stutter as a kid. I read that script. It was written by this guy, David Seidler, who was in his 70s when he had written the script. And we didn't even have an agent when I read the script. He had a manager who sent it to me. And then to see him go from that to winning the Academy Award for screenplay that year was really touching for me, because that those kind of stories don't happen.
When does this year's Blacklist come out?
December 17th.
All
right. Around the corner.
Right around the corner.
Well, you got to cop that list. Well, you don't have to pay for it.
So. It's available on our website. Yeah, on the day it
No,
comes
but
out.
Discover some new names,
yeah.
hopefully.
Yeah.
And follow those new names. The one thing that I think is really, that sort of drives me crazy, is that people don't, I think, have the appropriate reverence for the writers of their favorite movies.
Woo! Right? Say it.
Like, say that.
It's fine to love the actors, it's fine to love the directors, but like somewhere at some point, someone sat down and literally dreamed a world into existence. And like, I don't know, since I was a kid, I've always had awe for that. And I don't think we do that enough. So like, follow these people on social media, like, give them like a personal brand that they can sort of leverage in future making of films.
Thank you. Tell that to Hollywood.
Hey,
I remember when they were thinking
about trying.
The Academy Awards about how to trim it down. Wasn't one of their plans to like
cut the writing
categories?
Yeah. The number of deadline headlines I see where it's like star, movie, director. I'm like, who wrote, did they write that?
Preach. Couldn't agree more.
Right. Like, especially a new thing where it's like Tracy Oliver, or like Amy Aniobi wrote this movie. It's always right. like, oh, here's the producer, and then like you have to open it up and find out, oh, like the person who wrote Girls Trip wrote this movie, maybe tell me that in the headline.
And by the way,
because that's what people want to hear.
I was going to say, and it's good business. Right. If I know someone who wrote Girls Trip, I might want to check out their next movie. Right. Tell me that information.
I think that we underestimate how much the general public cares about, oh, this person wrote this movie. Let me go and see what they also wrote.
There's this big Hollywood Reporter oral history of Working Girl that just came out.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a movie I've seen 1,000 times. For whatever reason, I myself am a writer. I have never even thought about who wrote the movie. And to think about what inspired is very cool. So I really recommend everybody read it. It plugs you into the Blacklist mindset.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being here, Franklin.
It was an absolute pleasure.
I will see you at Equinox.
You will.
We always run into each other.
<It's true>. Usually as I'm gasping for air and just like, okay, I'm done. I'm not coming back here ever again. So.
Yeah, I'm just walking around.
I was going to say, what's Ira doing?
Ira's putting in work. Ira is putting in work.
My trainer found out I am back from Europe because he follows me on Instagram and already harassed
You're like
me.
Dodging your trainer?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd probably do the same.
Anyway, thank you again.
No, thanks for having
when
me.
We're back, keep it. And we're back with our favorite segment of the week. Hmm. As always, it's Keep It. Kara, it's been a long time.
It has.
And you left them without a dope beat to step to.
I'm back now. And I'm coming in hot. So I saw an article from GQ this week that...
Love Gentleman's Quarterly.
Yes. That wondered or posited that bootcut jeans might be making a comeback for men. And I would like to say, do we not have enough evil in the world? Are we not dealing with enough? Are we not fighting what feels like 18 wars on every front? Everything is stressful. We got a lot to worry about. We don't have time to deal with men wearing bootcut jeans again. We don't have the energy. We don't have the resources. I can't put up with that. I have enough that worries me every day when I step out of my house. I can't deal with watching a man walk down the street in bootcut jeans and square-toed dress shoes. I don't have the energy for it. I'm tired. We're not going to do this. You can delay this a few years when shit is a little bit calmer, and then we can address the idea of you all wearing those hideous pants again. In the meantime, leave us alone. Keep it. Keep on your straight-cut denim and keep it moving.
Didn't the photo that accompanied that article too? Like, the pants didn't look boot cut.
They looked
crazy. They were bunched up at the bottom.
They were very flared, yeah.
Apparently, it's like this one designer, and they're like, I don't know if he's trolling us, but I don't feel that we can afford to take this as a joke. You know, we need to take this seriously.
When I think of boot cut jeans, I think of Bobby Ewing in Dallas doing something sexy.
I think the last time boot cut jeans were cute, like, you know how, like, Julia Roberts fooled us into believing high-waisted jeans look good on everybody, and we were just wrong for 4 years? Cameron Diaz was the one person that like a low cut boot cut jean looked amazing on in 2000, and then unfortunately it infected us for a decade.
I don't know that anyone ever looks good in boot cut jeans. I gotta say, I'd have to revisit. I'm not confident They might.
You have to
Cameron
be
Diaz
pencil
might.
Thin.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But we don't need this.
We get it, Lewis. You wear bootcut jeans.
Oh my God! I of course not. I did used to. Yes, in a very serious way.
He's wearing them now.
Oh right, yeah.
What's your keep it?
Big fucking keep it to the rapping granny we're all supposed to love, Pope Francis. This guy who's been allegedly down with the kids for years, who, like, can, you know, is, like, super cool with his, like, hacky sacks and his...
Loved his cameo
his Trapper
on Big
Keepers.
Mouth.
Yeah, right. He is worried, quote, about the serious issue of homosexuality in the clergy, according to a book he's written. He said gay people should not join... That's right. Can you believe he had time? I'm shocked. he said gay people should not join the Catholic clergy and that homosexuality had, quote, become... fashionable. How many fucking times do you have to be yelled at by gay people before you realize that homosexuality is not like a slap bracelet or like a trend we're trying on, but it's actually people with motherfucking lives? This guy goes, in our societies, it even seems that homosexuality is fashionable and that mentality in some way also influences the life in the church. He said, this is something I am concerned about because perhaps at one time it did not receive much attention. And he says that people joining the church must be humanly and emotionally mature, which gay people are not. Hey, bitch, is it possible the fucking priesthood is the problem? Is it possible this is not that rad a vocation, that it ruins the lives of the people who join it, that this church is a fucking joke? I'm sorry, you think Jesus gives a shit about this stuff anymore? He, like, cashed out on Catholicism 20 years ago. He sold his shares. He's like, fuck it, I'll do real estate. This shit is over, bitch, and so are you.
You know what I... first thought when he said he was worried about homosexuality in the clergy, I was like, oh, good. Like, he was worried that the clergy or like that they were homophobic.
Yeah, right.
That's how I initially heard that. Yeah. And then
twist.
Twist.
It was not, coming from a caring place with human emotions.
You know what I think? We should just
fashionable.
No, we should just do the young pope for real.
Yeah,
we should make
Jude Law
the pope, and that's what we're doing now.
I would love the pope to just be walking around with like sexy chest hair
and in those all white tracksuits.
That's fashionable.
I love
like,
that.
Stop worrying about homosexuality being fashionable, and about how about you update that Popemobile
right.
that you've been driving around chasing the Joker in since 1964.
Also, if you're concerned about things being fashionable, it's like the one like requirement of this job is that you wear sleek ivory shit, and you still can't even do that right. So can we like work on a silhouette? How about that?
You should watch, everyone should, I mean, I loved the young Pope, but if you go, there's a scene where the Pope is getting dressed for like his big coronation or whatever it is to an LMFAO song. And it is ridiculous and unbelievable and hilarious. And let me tell you, he looked great.
Oh,
because
yeah.
it was Jude Law as the Pope. Again, that's the key to all of this is Jude Law needs to be the Pope.
You know what doesn't look great? Homophobia.
It does not.
It makes you age. Just makes you look gross.
Thank you for this testimonial from Paris is Burning or whatever this is.
I don't have to tell the Pope that he's ugly because he knows he's ugly.
He's ugly.
And that's shade. My keep it is also about a monster who hates gay people.
Who?
Andre Osserman.
No, he doesn't.
He is said that he would love a sequel to Call Me By Your Name. And in fact, he's writing one. He tweeted that the other day. And you know what the fuck? I don't want it.
You should tell him.
I don't want it.
Well, I mean, by the way, what would a sequel mean? Would it be then they're in their 30s? Because the book actually ends like 10 years after the romance when he's like 17 and he's 24.
Well, Lucio Guadagnino talked about how he saw it as, you know, potentially dealing with the AIDS crisis. And I don't want that.
Different story.
It was such a lovely story that was sort of before that all happened, and so it was nice to see, you know, a gay romance that was a period piece that wasn't hinging on the fact that people were dying around them. And
right.
I just feel like that makes it something else, and it makes it darker, and it's not the story that we wanted from them if that's in the sequel.
You know,
but also, if you do that sequel, you can't ignore it.
The larger issue, too, is we almost never need an anything too.
Yeah, right.
Almost never.
Not unless Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith are involved.
You almost never need anything to. Also, just three, four, certainly not. Just, we don't, we usually don't need a sequel.
Also, is Timothée Chalamet going to do a sequel to Call Me By Your Name?
Right.
I know Armie Hammer will keep doing them until someone pays attention and gives him an award.
Right. No, by the way, Andre Osimhen, who wrote the original book, straight man. Now, I do not like feeling this scene by someone straight. I'm just saying it has always made me uncomfortable that he got so many specific things right. And I just believe I should talk that out with him because it makes me confused.
Well, he read a lot of Craigslist ads.
So oh, you think that's what it was?
He knows what happens in our bedrooms. We're all eating peaches.
That's right.
I'm eating a peach right
now. In missed connections. Yes, yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Saw you eating a peach on the G train. Wish I could comment it.
Andre Osimhen taking notes on that. Ooh.
Yeah, I don't think we need a sequel to it.
No, you don't need a sequel
also,
to those movies.
Andre Osimhen, like, you have other books.
Right.
And some of them are queer, too. Just adapt those.
How do you feel about the Handmaid's Tale sequel that Margaret Atwood is writing now?
Is she?
No, I don't. I almost never want a sequel. The answer, other than, like, I get it with, like, comic book movies because those stories continue.
Yeah, they're sagas.
Like, yeah, but you almost never need a sequel.
There's a Handmaid's Tale 2 book coming out.
Is it just a documentary? Is it just what's happening now? If that's Handmaid's 2, if it's just clippings from the New York Times from people not letting women do anything with their bodies, then I will accept that as a sequel.
It's just Margaret Atwood like pointing out a window. She's like, here it
yes,
is.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
How old is she?
I mean, that book came out, 30 years ago? Yeah. So.
Does she have better things to do? And sitting down writing Handmaid's Tale 2.
Guy Branum, who was on the show once, interviewed her before. She does not like to be an easy interview. It was really good, but she was salting it up.
Do what? That. Do more funny, do more salty interviews yeah. instead of writing anything too.
Also, she has other books too.
That she does.
Can Hulu make one of them?
I bet they can.
I guess she wants to write something.
Mm-hmm.
Who am I to
selfish.
Begrudge?
Yeah.
Write whatever you want. Write your Call Me By Your Name sequel, too. Whatever.
That was a reversal.
Everybody just do whatever the fuck you want in 2019, because that's what I want to do. I just want to drink kava and be on vacation.
Okay.
But I have to come back and do this show.
You do.
Whatever. We'll see you next week.
Question. Are you politically engaged and spiritually exhausted?
If you said yes to both, welcome home. I'm Erin Ryan.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco.
And we're the hosts of Hysteria, the podcast for women who care about democracy, culture, and not losing their minds in the process.
We break down the news, call out the nonsense, and spotlight the women actually fighting back on Capitol Hill, in classrooms, and everywhere the stakes are high.
It's sharp, honest analysis featuring women's voices with humor and zero hand-holding.
Listen to Hysteria wherever you get your podcasts and watch full episodes on YouTube.